Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. Food Talk here. I guess it's the second week, third week we're live. I think second week, right? Because I missed the first week. We were out of the country in Bordeaux. Yeah, that was a fun trip. Still talking about that one. Here's today's show in a nutshell, so you know what you're tuning in for. Although you probably already know because you're on iTunes and Stitcher and you've read what it is. But I'll tell you anyway, because this is old school radio. You're supposed to do this. We've got two guests. That's it. Florence Fabricant is going to be with me right off of the bell. Great food writer, has been writing in the New York Times food section for about as long as I can remember. We're going to talk about a book that she just co-authored with Eric Repair called The City Harvest Cookbook. I think that's what it's called. She'll correct me if I'm wrong. I probably am. But it's great. We'll talk about that with Florence, and then as that runs its course, maybe 10, 12 minutes into the show, we're going to do a quick break, switch gears, and do something I could do forever with someone whom I could do it with forever. We're going to talk wine and food with Pascalina Pelletier, and we're lucky enough to have the chef from Rouge Tomate, which is soon to reopen, Andy Bennett, who I met a couple of years ago, and we were filming there. Rouge Tomate, if you don't know, is a restaurant in New York City. Was on 60th or 61st and 5th Avenue, right around the corner from the Pierre, in the old Copacabana space. It was in that huge space, that humongous space with that huge kitchen. And they were also uptown, and, you know, this being New York and I live downtown, I know the subway goes north to south and sometimes even east to west if you want it to, but I kind of stay south if I can. I kind of live downtown. So cool news, the reopening in Chelsea. We're going to talk about Rouge Tomate's second edition, Rouge Tomate 2.0, with Pascalina and the chef. I want to give a shout out. A couple things happened this week. Drew Nieporant had his 25th anniversary party for Tribeca Grill. Bobby De Niro was there. That's right. Bobby D himself in the flesh. And everybody was there. I mean, there's so many chefs that have come through that, through Drew's empire over the years, Myriad Group, between Monrecher, Corton, now Batard, Tribeca Grill, assorted other ventures, Nobu, et cetera, et cetera. So many restaurateurs that Drew was known. So it was so great to just catch up with all of those people sitting around one room and celebrating what's been really a transformation of that neighborhood. And a lot of that was because of what Drew did in the early days on Drew's watch. Had a great Portuguese wine tasting, went to this week. We'll talk about Portuguese wines, but I'll save all that stuff for Pascaline, because Pascaline and I could do this forever. Pascaline, I should have to tell you, besides being a dear friend and so knowledgeable, my son has been intrigued. He met her the day we filmed at Rouge Tomate. He came for like the post-dinner bacchanal that we had in the private dining room. There was about 10 of us at the table at least. And Pascaline was running up and down the steps with wines. He's like, who is that? And I'm like, she's like the wine god. Like, just listen and shut up, kid. Since then, he's become a total foodie, total wine guy. He spends every cent of his disposable income on wine, which is crazy. I suppose worse things could happen. But he got to have dinner with Pascaline at Fung Tu a while back. That was one of the highlights of his summer, let me tell you. And every time he guessed something wrong, she would tap him on the head. No. Anyway, let's go to my guest, the great food writer, the great New York food writer, such a presence in this city, Florence Fabricant, who has been writing in the food section of the Times, probably back to when it was the Friday section. I don't know. I didn't fact check all that stuff, but now it's the Wednesday section. And I can just, a little shout out before I have Florence live. She's so impressive. You know, she's a great food writer. We all read the Wednesday Times religiously for the reviews, but I love her two columns, which kind of tell you what's going on. We just had the big fall thing that she did at the beginning of September about who's going to open up in the next 3 months. And you just, your notebook's full of brimming with notes of what's going to happen, because she's curated this list for you. But when she writes about food and actually kind of bores down, I'll give an example. She did a piece when Nick Morgenstern first opened up Morgenstern's. Nick's a pastry chef, turned restaurateur, turned ice cream maven, and all sorts of things these days. But Florence came down to do the story with Nick, and went down to off the Bowery where he is. And Nick was just like stunned at how much she knew about everything, like about ice cream. Like there was no explanation needed. She knew everything he was doing and needed no explanations. And Nick was like, are you kidding me? So Florence, welcome to Food Talk on Heritage Radio.
Hi there.
Sorry you had to listen to all that. How are you?
Good. I'm great. And you?
Good. Thank you. Keep up the great, great, great work. You've been writing for the Times. Am I allowed to ask you how long have you been writing in the food column?
Oh, dear. I think my trial period is over.
Okay. We'll leave it at that. We will leave it at that. So talk about the new book. And I'm so bad. I didn't bring a copy of me, bring it with me to the radio because I bicycle. Is it called the City Harvest Cookbook? What's it called?
Yeah, City Harvest, 100 Recipes from Great New York Restaurants.
And you wrote it, and I should say more or less co-wrote it with Eric Repair.
Well, not really. Okay. I wrote it. And he wrote the foreword because he is such an important engine at City Harvest.
You tell this great story. So we've had people from City Harvest here. Anytime they want to come on, I say, please come into the studio. We'll do it on the phone. If there's an event to promote, I did the same thing when I had the food talk on WOR. Because in this city, when you know, a lot of us, a bad night out is we didn't like the wine pairings with our 10-course tasting menu. There's a million people in New York. Over a million that struggle with hunger. So talk about like your early exposure. I know in the open of the book you talk about sitting at some kind of a fancy schmancy dinner in Paris in 1982 and trying to explain to the French what City Harvest was about. Talk about that and about the sort of the evolution of how City Harvest came to be and what it does.
Well, City Harvest, I mean, it was like number two, the first organization that really paid attention to hunger and began to make a contribution in a big way with City Meals on Wheels,
which Gail Green
started to provide weekend meals to the homebound elderly who otherwise would have nothing. They were only fed during the week. And then along came City Harvest, realizing that all of this food was not the food for the elderly, but the food in general at restaurants, at caterers, at photo shoots even, grocery stores, was being thrown away. And they thought there's got to be a better use for this. And so they began collecting food and using it for soup kitchens to give good food to the homeless. And it just has mushroomed. The incident you mentioned, which I described in my introduction, was in 1983. I was at a black tie dinner in Paris and sitting next to some guy and talking about how in the U.S., cultural institutions are more or less on their own. They don't get much in the way of government funding. Whereas in Europe, they all get government funding, and they don't have to constantly tap their donors. That's changing now. But back then, that was pretty much the situation. And I said, but, you know, private initiative can do so much. And I said, for example, there is City Harvest, this group that collects food and distributes it to the homeless and so forth. And he was dumbfounded.
Right.
He said, oh, we would never do that in Paris. Well, guess what? They're doing it. So it's taken off, and it now exists not only all over the U.S., but certainly in other countries as well. And it's really admirable.
Yeah, and there's such a need for this. And, I mean, we've again, I worked with the shelter down on Lafayette Street for years because that was a neighbor of WOR back when we were down, when I was with them down there. So we would always do fundraisers for them. I don't think people realize in this city where, you know, these condominiums seem to be sprouting like mushrooms, in the northern parts of Midtown Manhattan that are selling for $35, $40 million per apartment on a regular basis, that this is a city where 1.4 million residents struggle with hunger on a daily basis.
Yeah. I know, and you know, what really gets me is you see a woman with a toddler at her side with a paper cup on the subway or some guy who says, I've had nothing to eat for 24 hours, give me 25 cents. And I say to myself, don't these people know that there are resources that the, you know, that the city does provide? There are places they can go and get food and they don't have to beg, which is the truth. But the reach of these programs apparently is not deep enough.
Yeah, you're right. But it, so, okay, so well, back to the book. It's great. So you did, again, you have an introduction. I guess with books like this, Eric, and I guess to some extent you reached out to the vast network of super talented chefs that populate the kitchens of New York restaurants.
Well, I depended on the people at City Harvest to come up with the list of contributing restaurants, caterers, food producers to help me narrow the list, so to speak. And then they reached out and asked each restaurant for two recipes, that just the titles of two recipes that they would contribute for this book. And from that list, I then assembled the book, and then we got the recipes, and then I wrestled them to the ground.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I want to get to. Because, you know, as someone who's in the media, I mailed cookbooks like every spring and every fall when they cut, and spring, fall, because it's like there's two, three cookbook seasons. And so many of them, I just get them and I open them up and I look at them, and you could just, I'm cooked all my life. You can just look at these recipes and say, they're not going to work. They're not going to work. No way. I don't care what the picture looks like. It's not going to work. But you were getting recipes from chefs, and some of them, I'm sure, were perfect as they came in off of the email or wherever you got them. And others
barely,
because, you know, others, you know, Michael White's recipe that he sent you was like, you know, to feed 60 people. So you have to figure out, how do I do this for four or six?
Right.
And what can I winnow out? What are maybe the couple of techniques or couple of ingredients? So this is a thoroughly vetted book via you.
Yeah. I mean, I've prepared every single one of these recipes, often more than once. And a lot of the recipes that I got in the initial round, I rejected because they either called for ingredients that were just too difficult for home cooks to obtain, or you had to sous vide something before you even started the recipe, or, you know, or it was a cut of meat that you could only get if you
have Pat Lafreda's phone number
on the farm, you know, that kind of thing. And of course, I'm not going to suggest that people do that at home. But then there were some surprises. The biggest one might be this recipe from David Boulay called Forager's Treasure of Wild Mushrooms. Now, I had that dish in the restaurant, and it is just divine. And there must have been, conservatively, 1,000 kinds of mushrooms on my plate. and he sent me the recipe, and it looked really tricky. There were, you know, most chef's recipes come in a whole collection of parts that you've got to assemble. And cook each recipe separately before you put the whole thing together. Well,
right.
I know how to do that, and very often I will just not even bother with some of the accessories. But this recipe turned out to be relatively easy and so delicious, and I was just thrilled. It was one of the biggest surprises.
Yeah, and Boulay, I mean, this I've known, well, you know, the only good thing about being a certain age, you've got a great sense of history in New York. I remember David when he was in that opening team with Drew at what was Montrachet back in the mid. A super talented guy. I mean, a real chef. Maybe not the best businessman in the world, but no one will argue he's a chef, and has so many great kitchen cooks have come out of that kitchen. You also have a couple of things that are kind of cool in this book that are a little bit different. The one with cook's notes, which kind of each recipe kind of highlights something about the technique or something to be aware of and look for. And then this idea, which is kind of apropos of City Harvest and what it does, of what to do with leftovers should you have them.
Yeah.
Second helpings, you called it.
Yeah, second helpings, right. It wasn't always leftovers, but it was something to stretch the recipe somehow, either stretch the ingredients or use the leftovers like the macaroni and cheese, any leftovers where there probably won't be, but never mind. You could slice it and fry it. And that kind of thing, I think, also helps people because people at home throw away a ton of food because they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, I think too many people, if you ask them right now to open your refrigerator and empty everything that's in there, there's stuff in the vegetable bin, stuff in those little plastic containers that go back 3 weeks.
Yeah, these science experiments in the back of the fridge.
And let's not even talk about people in their freezers.
The second helpings feature will capture these ingredients before they turn into science experiments.
So my guest has been Florence Fabricant, the great Florence Fabricant, who writes two weekly columns in the New York Times. She is on the food scene, has been for quite some time. And absolutely, again, a shout out from Nick Morgenstern, I'm sure a lot of the chefs you work with, for how you come into these interviews with them and these articles so well prepared that you've done your homework. You know the backstory. The name of the book is The City Harvest Cookbook. And you tell me, I'm assuming that all the proceeds for this book are going directly to that charity.
Yeah.
Super. Thanks for the great work you do for the New York Times. Thanks for this great book. And you're going to hear me say something I rarely ever say on the radio. If you're looking for one cookbook to give as a gift this year where I can tell you all the recipes are going to work, and that's a real anomaly these days, trust me, this is one of those. It's a great cause, beautifully written, with recipes that will actually work in your home kitchen. Thanks to Florence. Thanks for so much for coming on the radio with me.
Thank you very much, Mike, and happy holidays to you, too.
Thank you. You as well. Folks, stay where you are. My next guest in studio is Pascaline Lepeltier. We're going to talk about the new opening of Rouge Tomate with her and her chef, Andy Bennett. And you're going to hear a lot of wine talk. We're going to have a quick break, and we'll be back with Pascaline. Folks, Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable sourced olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavitas living in Rome, Colavitas living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. Hey, it's me again, Colomeco. A couple of my favorite people here in the studio with me. This is, I think, probably the third or 20th time I've had Pascaline. And every chance I get to either hang out, rub elbows with, or just pester about wine, Pascaline Lepeltier is my choice. And Chef Andy Bennett, who I met a couple of years ago when we filmed a segment of Michael McCo's Real Food at the original Rouge Tomate. You were then Chef de Cuisine. What was it? Did you have a title? Yeah, Chef de Cuisine. And I remember this guy was rail thin, looked like he worked out. I'm like, dude, what do you do? And he's like, yeah, I bicycle, like, you know, 600 miles a week. Yeah, you'll look like it.
At least.
So, congratulations on the reopening, which is imminent. We're looking at November, December, hopefully, because it's never exact in New York. There's always those little fire department things, and does the hood work, and is the gas company, especially now with that explosion, like, is the gas all, like, perfect? So who knows? But it's going to happen. It's done.
We're getting closer.
Okay.
And it's starting to feel real.
Let's start with the food, which is Pascaline, if you don't mind, because we're going to get to wine.
I would love
to. Let's talk about the food. So one of the things, I don't eat much during the day. I'm kind of like a dinner guy, because it's just, I have to eat. I've got to pick my calories carefully, let's put it that way. And I also love working out on an empty stomach. I work out really hard, so I just don't usually eat anything until dinner, and I stay downtown. So for that reason, I really didn't get much of a chance to eat at Rouge Tomate, even though I work out two blocks away. But First time I go there was, you know, the subway, the F train, actually, runs from my neighborhood. Anyway, like, dude, you have a subway system works? You've been here since when? 82? Yeah. So I took the subway up, and I remember the meal. Gabriella Gershenson, who's a real foodie, was with me, and she asked me a tasting menu for us. Pascal, you were on the floor for most of that night. You had to run, but you paired wines with us till almost the end. They were all great, and it was the first time I met you. And the food was just like, what the hell? It was fucking delicious. And it never occurred to me. It was just never like I had to, like, redo my homework. So the conceit, kind of the thought process behind Rouge Tomate is it's super healthy food by design. You're the only restaurant I know that has like a nutritionist on the payroll. Still.
Yep.
Still. So your hands, to some extent, are slightly tied with the amounts of sugar, with the amounts of butter, with the amounts of heavy cream, even olive oil. I mean, fat's fat. Yeah, there's better fats and not-so-good fats. But your every single recipe you develop for the public is vetted by a nutritionist. You're doing them in tandem.
Correct.
How is that, man?
It's...
You can say it sucks if you want to.
No. I mean, what it does to you, I think, firstly, it's... For me, it's a very natural process. Just because my palate always leans towards clean, fresh flavors. So even though maybe butter or heavy cream as examples you can use and they have their own flavor profiles,
right.
Keeping them out or keeping them in minimal quantities gives you the ability to be able to really kind of hone in on what a carrot actually tastes like,
right.
What a beet actually tastes like, opposed to, you know, something where you may be glazing or... Hide in, you know, the actual kind of pure essence of those ingredients.
Because in some ways, I mean, I can like chef to chef, in some ways, butter, heavy cream, olive oil, bacon fat, the fucking shortcuts.
Yep.
It's like a chef's cheap way to go. You want flavor? Hand me that tablespoon of butter, and I'm just going to glaze everything over with that, or goose fat, or bacon. I mean, it's a shortcut. You're guaranteed to people's palates respond. The other way is a lot more subtle, a lot more difficult, but in the end, I agree with you, yields like this much cleaner palate.
I mean, I think the hardest thing a lot of time, a lot of chefs struggle with is vegetable dishes or vegetarian dishes. You're fighting for a lot of reasons, whether it's people's perception of what value on the plate is,
right.
Being able to see what, you know, that protein is. So the number one thing you're trying to do is make people forget that there's no protein on the plate. So how are you going to do that? How are you going to make this interesting so that every bite they're getting, they're not all of a sudden they're forgetting about their 10-ounce ribeye, and all of a sudden they're getting these textures and these flavor profiles and this kind of depth to vegetables that I think sometimes people don't think are possible. So a lot of that, I think, is kind of based, you know, what we try to focus on at Rouge Tomate is to kind of break down that perception of A, what is healthy food, and B, show that you can use maybe some ingredients that are perceived to be unhealthy. A lot of it's about the proportion on the plate, or how you use that, or using proteins as a seasoning, which, you know, you're seeing more and more of.
You are. Michael Anthony. I don't know if you've seen it. Michael Anthony just has a book. He's going to be on this show in a couple of weeks. Maybe next week. I don't know. In the next couple of weeks, anyway. Called V is for Vegetables. And it's, I mean, here's this... You know, Gramercy Tavern for years. Now we're just Untitled, or whatever the heck it's called over there. Super well-respected New York chef. And he's just devoting this book to vegetable cookery. And I think you began to see that change maybe in the late 90s, even early aughts in New York. Because I remember in my day, you know, I don't think there were that many. I think the proportion of vegetarians has increased a lot. People are eating differently now. Because I remember when I worked at restaurants, if someone came in and ordered a vegetarian plate, they were so screwed it was a joke. It was like, all right, what are the six vegetables we have? We have a couple of snow peas, a little bit of potato, peel a couple of carrots. It was just like whatever you had laying around without any thought. That was it. That's what you wanted. You know,
in the mid-90s was the grilled vegetable platter.
Which is kind of a sad embarrassment.
Yeah.
And then you think of the great kitchens now. I think, like, when I looked at the 11 Madison Park cookbook, you know, that carrot shot that he has, you know, those roast carrots. Like, great vegetables have so much flavor. And in a way, honestly, they're so much more challenging. I mean, any idiot can buy a really nice piece of prime beef or center-cut tuna, throw it on a goddamn grill, cook it medium rare, salt and pepper it, and... Great, it's delicious. But, you know, cooking Swiss chard, cooking beets, cooking things creatively, vegetables actually take a lot more chops than the protein does.
Yeah, you need, I think, definitely a lot more finesse. And even, you know, as you talk about vegetable cookery, even as it relates to garnishes for protein dishes, I think you can really look at it as that, you know, the, you know, maybe the same 50 restaurants are buying this same cut of beef. So it's the garnishes that are going to make that dish, you know, it's the vegetable component that's going to make the dish a standout opposed to just another beef dish.
And there's a lot more work. I have to, again, because as a guy that ran kitchens, I think for the longest time, when you're running a restaurant as a chef, you're struggling with food cost. It's a big number. You sit down with owners with all the time. Labor cost is another big number. And proteins were kind of an easy, effective way to stick something in the middle of the plate to get people's attention, do a good job with it. Vegetables take a lot of prep. And I know when I cook dinner for myself at home, I'm a huge fan of vegetables. Like at one point, I had to go on a, quote, diet years ago. And all I did was shrink the protein and triple up the vegetables. But then, I find that, like, I could go to a farmer's market, Union Square yesterday, or I've got an organic one down by me in Cape May in the summer, where I'll go and I'll buy like two bunches of Swiss chard that look like two bunches, like nice size, looks like it's going to feed like eight people, right? Yeah. And then you get the Swiss chard and you cut the stems and I use the whole thing, but I wash them, spin it in a vegetable dryer, put it in a plastic, it still looks huge. And then I put it in a saute pan over some garlic or so, whatever else I'm going to do, it's two people. Yep. It's fucking two, and I'm like, what the hell, man? I thought either this is going to be like leftovers for 3 days. No. Vegetables are like really labor intensive, and those leafy ones just shrink down to nothing.
Yeah, our refrigerator storage was, you know, and will be at, you know, the new location is 80% vegetables, you know, and everything else, it's almost kind of the reverse of what you see in a lot of restaurants.
Right.
It's like, you know, so much space is dedicated just to that side of the menu.
And I have, and kudos to you, and Pascaline, forgive me for doing this, because I really had a, the Bordeaux trip was fantastic. Bordeaux as a city used to be a dump. I remember going to Bordeaux in the 90s, and it was just this gray, depressing shithole that you couldn't wait to leave. And now you go back, and it's like, what the F happened? It's like clean, it's white, it's sparkling, population's increasing, they got this great new electric trolley system, everyone's on bicycles, looks like Brooklyn, but actually it doesn't look like Brooklyn. I don't know what it looks like. It's got the energy of Brooklyn, it's one of the few French cities that's super fucking alive, is what I'm trying to say. It's so energetic, the population's expanding, it's pretty soon they've got a TGV coming in from Paris, it's going to be 2 hours, huh? But here's my rub. My God, the whole time I'm there, I'm like, this is like I was in Gascony when something happened. I'm there for like 3 days, and I have not had a vegetable yet. I'm going out to restaurants, and it's like fish, meat, potato, fish. And I remember just saying, like, can we go to a vegetarian place tonight? Do you have vegetables? Can I see your walk-in box? It was like, my digestive system was just like shut down. So I don't know what's up with that over there. But anyway, the wine was good. I'll leave that out of
I'm
that.
I'm glad.
So, Pascaline, let me get you in this conversation. Because the great thing about this show is we don't have commercials, so I don't have to look at the clock at all. So, first of all, and I'm going to keep doing this to embarrass you, congratulations. No, because it's so, like, chong, 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 master, psalm. That's so epic. It's so impossibly hard to do that. It's so ridiculous. You know what? I don't know why I waited. I didn't watch the movie Psalm until, like, last year. And now my kid watches it. My 23-year-old watches it, like, on demand. And he's, like, picking his favorite guy in his favorite room. And he'll taste wine at the table and, like, give me quotes. And my other, that's my youngest son, who's not really even into wine. My other son, Sean, you know him. You've met him. Congratulations on it. That's still huge. It's so epic. And you were such a, you know, sometimes you meet these masters of wine and some of these master psalms, and it's just like, oh my God, these are the most boring, bookish, like the kind of doctrinaire, but yeah, all right, I'll shut up. You're the best. That's all I want to say. So tell me about the wine list, because a lot of it, all of it, what, because you got it, now you're getting to plate. I mean, obviously you brought the bottles from uptown, downtown, but you're curating new stuff all the time. How much of it is natural / organic / bio? Talk to me about the choices, the selection, and what we're going to find in the wine list at the new Rouge Tomate.
It's still a secret. No.
She's not going to tell us anything about that.
I'm blushing right now. No, but just what, you know, Andy, and what we're going to try to do with the new one is just to be more committed compared to the previous one. You know, it's going down is just allowing us to push a boundary a bit more than what we're able to do uptown. So concerning the wine program, it's just the same idea, but more. So I, like, number-wise, I don't know. I'm putting the list together right now, but probably around 80 to 90% at least, yeah. Just because it's the way we're thinking the restaurant together, you know, it's amazing to be in a team where everything is in the same pace and we have the same vision. So, you know, the idea that the food is going to be even more committed to where it's from and how is it grown and how is it prepared and cooked, I just couldn't, like, remain where I was. It's like, no, I need to be even more an activist than I ever been for the wine program and the beverage program in general because it's what we're believing into. Mm-hmm. So it's gonna be the same focus and of course without compromising quality. Like it needs to be first and foremost good because we are gonna be in the restaurant to take care of people. So hospitality and being hospitable is caring first about the guests, but making the homework to provide them with what we think is probably the best source product we can find for them at a very good price, which is also something we are very careful about in the new location. We are going to try to be more approachable than ever. Yeah. You don't have to live on the Upper East Side to eat and drink well. You know, it should be something that everybody can have access to. And this engagement for us was... It's kind of a key of how we are thinking right now, what we are going to put on the menu there. It's like, it needs to be affordable and approachable more than ever. So how do we do that?
Yeah, I mean, taking, you know, all our old philosophies and, you know, making that accessible while still being creative and dynamic and, you know, attention to our source and, but maybe stripping away, you know, some of the unnecessary components so you end up with, okay, what's important here? It's hospitality, it's great beverage program, it's center of the plate, and that being, you know, the focus of what the restaurant's about.
Which is really, again, I'm just going to go back to this because it really is unique to me, this vision of a restaurant that has a nutritionist, dietitian, whatever you want to call it, on staff 7 days a week. There was an article a while back, you know, one of these kind of supposed shine the light exposés on, you know, if you did the tasting menu at Per Se, how many calories you consumed, and of course it was, you know, 60 million. And I think for many years as chefs, myself included, I was guilty of this. I was trying to make food that was would give pleasure, that I knew that my dining public was going to be paying for it, but they would leave sated, they'd leave satisfied. And that often meant diet was the last of my concern. And so I think for a lot of years, chefs just thought, like, you don't come to my restaurant to diet. You want to diet on your day off at home. You can eat rice crackers and celery for 3 days before you come here. When you come here, screw you. I'm feeding you. Just enjoy it. Go with it. But you guys, it's the other way around. And I think for the longest time, that's kind of how restaurants viewed themselves was, look, that's not what we do. I mean, we will salt till the end of the earth because we love salt. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of tablespoons of butter that get thrown in pans at the end just for that mouthfeel. Even vegetable plates to sort of bind whatever liquid was in the pan and just give it. Because butter's butter and heavy cream's heavy cream and lipids work that magical effect. And it wasn't our responsibility, but you guys, I mean, and then there was like the health food restaurants where the shit was like inedible. It was like brown, chewy, granular poop. You know, I never wanted to eat my, you know, macro.
Where was it?
Just all those places in East Village with those funny names. And everyone that eats in them looks terrible. They're all scrawny and their skin's falling out and shit. No, but stuff. It's like there is no way you're eating it. You're at Rouge Tomat, and I'm sure now that you're in charge, there's no way you're eating there and you're conscious of the fact that the food on the plate actually is super healthy. It's delicious. So you pull it off,
and that's the, you know, always the ultimate goal is that we're trying to produce something that is delicious, and you know, byproduct of that is that it's healthy for you. But I think, you know, once you start to, you know, we can focus on that kind of side of it. But really, once you start to strip it back and you're kind of, you know, some people say, oh, isn't that restrictive because you can't use these ingredients and, you know, or you can't finish it with butter, you can't finish it with cream. But it really opens things up a lot more because it forces you, A, to be creative. How are we going to get this texture of mouthfeel without using butter or cream? Or how are we going to start exploring these different products in a different way where they can really stand up to themselves instead of being hidden by butter or cream or being, you know, secondary kind of item. So really it opens up the kind of platform, and, you know, like I say, been able to really kind of hone in on the quality of their product and let that quality kind of shine through, I think is important, especially as it relates to, like Pascaline was saying, you know, we go to great lengths to source the right products, and the farmers and producers go to great lengths to make these great products. And then it would be kind of injustice for us to, you know, then hide it and kind of, you know, mask it with all these other things. Essentially, we're trying to let those products, you know, sing kind of through, as you will.
Jeremy was the preview chef.
Yeah.
I remember spending a day with him before we shot. I ate, had dinner, and then spent some time in the kitchen before we shot a day separately, just to see what it was about. So I kind of had to wrap my head around what's the show going to be. I'm pretty good at winging it, but this was winging it where I hadn't gone yet. Like, all right, it's a health food restaurant. Oh, fuck, what am I going to do now? So to your point, it was, and I think you said it well, instead, like, an initial chef's reaction is, okay, we're really going to cut down on salt, sugar, processed flours, and all the lipids that we rely on as the backbones. In one sense, you think, oh my God, that's restrictive. And then suddenly, once you begin to like go through that little hole in the hourglass, it's liberating. Because it's like, oh, so if we're doing a dish with like a cauliflower feel, rather than doing some heavy velouté, and why don't we use like a cauliflower puree, like the product itself. And it's like suddenly you find yourself cooking. And the guy that comes to mind, and this is a throwback, he's actually still alive, is... Michel Girard was the guy, Cuisine Monsieur.
Yep. Yeah.
So here's a French chef of probably a little older than me. Who knows? Who knows anymore?
Yeah, older
but
than you.
A little, like a day. But I remember, like, this was this iconic French chef out of that sort of Nouvelle Cuisine tradition. Blew up, you know, 3-star Michelin in the 70s. And at some point, I think for his own health reasons, he just had to learn how to cook lighter, and Cuisine Monsieur was born out of that. This super clean, and then you sort of saw Luthier, and then when John George first came to New York, he was this like early ambassador of no stock reductions, no butter, no beurre blanc. No. It was like broths, and it was almost there was definitely an Asian influence. It was coming from France at that point. This guy was just making like this healthier, lighter version of the heavy stuff that we'd all been playing with for years. And you're kind of that's the baton that you've been passed.
Yeah, exactly, and it's, you know, it's interesting. You start to, you know, you start to. There's some of these techniques that have, you know, already been around for a long time, and some of them, are, you know, essentially, you know, straightforward. You're replacing a heavy meat stock with a vegetable stock that you're making out of the trimming. So, you know, you've got this kind of continued utilization of products. So, you know, if you're making a cauliflower dish, you make a cauliflower stock and then a cauliflower puree, and then all of a sudden you've got something that resembles the mouthfeel of cream, and then, right, you know, you're gonna take that one step further. Yeah, so it's, you know, I think it's interesting, and the thing that shocked me the most is that once you started tasting all these products, you started realizing these very slight variances in these crazy things, like, you know, getting spinach from one farm and another farm, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, these taste completely different. They don't taste just like spinach. These are two totally different things.
Like terroir in food.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah,
there was Rowan Jacobson years ago, well, not that many years ago, wrote a book, American Terroir, and it was about, he picked oysters and a few other things, and he talked just about that we think of this word wine that's sort of debated. I don't know, I think it's really debatable, but they're, I guess, non-believers, and go fuck them. But... you know, this idea that things taste of a place, of a soil, of an elevation, of an exposure, and that even within, like, with wine, it seems obvious because we have a name for it and we can talk about it forever. But you see the same thing in corn, in potatoes, in tomatoes, and why not, right?
Yeah, and it's I don't know, it's kind of, I don't know, it was mind blowing at first, you know, because all of a sudden, like you say, you attach that to wine, but people weren't necessarily attaching it to food so much, and not in a smaller region. People would say, yeah, maybe the best tomatoes are coming from Italy, or, you know, it's such a broader spectrum because everyone's flying all this food in all the time across the world. And all of a sudden you're realizing these variances from, you know, up and down the East Coast because, you know, the weather pattern is just, one season starting earlier than the other one, you know, and how they change over the course of the season. So,
no, it's people talk about Jersey tomatoes, and I laugh. I'm like, there is no such thing. Jersey has so many soil types, so many elevations. I mean, down by me, it's all sand, and up north, it's clay. And I mean, it's exact like there is no, yeah, the Jersey makes some really good tomatoes. If the weather's right, if the summer's not too rainy, in the right soil, yeah, you can get a wonderful tomato. Italian tomatoes, southern Italy has so many varieties of tomatoes. And I was actually in San Marzano once because I really wanted to see, like, why are these tomatoes celebrated? Flew into Rome, flew down to Naples, drove up to Sarno, and I was expecting to see, like, what I thought tomato farming was in America, these big fields of, like, No, these were people that were living in, like, cinder block houses that had a hectare, a half a hectare, and they got six tomato crops in, out of the year, because that's it's a long season, and they're just these beautiful, elongated, funny-looking, banana-like tomatoes, and the water's coming right off of Mount Vesuvius. The water table was, like, right below. It was, like, perfect. And we were drinking. Wasn't the best idea. I didn't get sick. We're drinking the water out of these, like, little cisterns, like unfiltered groundwater, and it was just beautiful. And that's so, wait a second, soil, volcanic soil, super clean water, that's right, that's what makes them unique. So that's one micro region in Italy. So Pasqualine, if you don't mind, back to you for a quick second. I don't want to shill for something that hasn't happened yet, but I know you're working on a book with a good friend of mine. Another great wine writer, another great New Yorker. I was firing. Talk about that, because it's going to be a book on, drum roll.
On dirt.
Okay, that's one way to put it.
Oh, yeah. It's a pretty, like, just to just talk about what Andy was talking, what you were talking, Alice had this pretty brilliant idea a couple of years ago that there is no such book for beginners that were considering the world of wine through the idea of the main soil and the main type of soil. It was just about either you go to the grapes or you go through geography. But the more we taste and the more we say, you know what, there is difference and it's based on partially on the soil. So what about not becoming geologists but just offering another perspective that just can lead to some reflection. So yeah, we are working on that book where the idea is we break down the main type of soil, the magmatic soil, the sedimentary soil, the metamorphic soil, and then we take the main wine region that are on this soil, and then we are going to talk about the grape and the producer we like in that. And it should be a book you put in your bag. It's like not too big. It's going to be very, like, a lot of research, but very approachable, and you're going to get into the world of wine in a different way, where you say, okay, maybe everything starts with the dirt under your feet and the sky above you, and there
that's
is a plant
so,
between that.
Does it have a title yet?
Dirt.
How cool is that? Because it's so
it
funny.
It should be dirt. Like,
so much of, you know, the pleasure that we get from drinking wine, so it seems so logical and so funny that no one's done this before, but your whole life's been doing this. And just in the past year, I got to fly to Alsace and hung out with Jos Meyer and Umbrecht and those guys on the Rangen Slope and talk organics there, where, you know, it's pretty big because of the Steiner influence in Germany and the Alsatian border. But so much of Alsatian wine producing, I was not aware because they're not bragging about it. It's not even on the label. Weinbach, they've been saying we've been bio since the mid-90s. You know what? And the soil was alive and funky, and the vines look great. And then we were in Sicily this year on Mount Etna and traveling around there. And I'm always putting a shovel in the ground, like kicking, like, what's it look like? What's it look? Is it growing? And then unfortunately, sometimes you visit places where they spray a lot and everything kind of looks dead. You know, there's just rows and rows of grapes and nothing on the ground really at all. We just got back from Bordeaux where they're even there where you don't think there's a lot going on. There's a younger generation of winemakers coming up that are composting and going organic and trying to get bio and getting clean. And as we're tasting wine, as we're sure that initial, you know, we do the analysis of the, you do, of the color and the weight, and we're guessing and walking. And then, but that wonderful, that middle palate and that mineral finish, sometimes it can almost feel like I'm chewing stones, white wines. But sometimes I almost get that sense of schist or granite or limestone. You know, it's so integral, and yet no one's written that book yet.
Yeah, it's like it's not going to be the idea of you grow on slate and you taste slate.
No.
It's not that, because it's very debatable and there is a lot of layers on that. But it's just offering another approach, saying, like, you know, there is a way to think about one that is not just varietal based of more geographical base, there is this geological thing that going to allow you to maybe compare to one region you were not necessarily comparing before, like, you know, the slate and the schist from the Loire and the slate and the schist from Priorat and the one from Mosel, and we are just
those
putting,
three have that in common.
We are putting these three regions together, and like one is Riesling, one is Chenin Cab, the other one is Grenache, but maybe there is, you know, something to think about that this way, and it's getting people excited about wine in a way that, and an angle that hasn't been really tackled down for beginners. You can find that at a higher level, but you want to give that for beginners, saying, hey, maybe worth you to think about where the plant is growing as your entry to the world of wine, and maybe it's going to help you to just get excited and understand something, otherwise you are missing just thinking the varietal, because we know that a Chardonnay grown on different type of soil and climate is not going to give the same thing. So what about talking about that, you know? And yeah, and so it's and we want that to be very approachable for everybody. I think it's something that is more and more important for me is maybe you're lucky because you've been studying and you know a lot, and you know, chef, you know a bunch of techniques and you taste a bunch of wine, but if you're not able to give it back at the most simple level for everybody, there is no point. You know, it's like you just stay in your little sphere of geeky people,
right,
and it's kind of it's an elitism, you know. And,
no, completely.
And so if you're lucky to know, and if you're lucky to have access, if you're lucky to understand, I think the minimum you can do is to give it back at a simple level to reach as many people as you can. And it's why I think we are so happy to work together, because we have the same, and for Rouge, I think we have the same feeling about that, about how do you make that more simple and show people that, yes, you can learn, you can get into something, things that seems to be impossible or overly ruled, you can walk around and create your own zone of freedom, of learning experience from that. And this is a key, so for the wine, for the food, for at every level. So even for the restaurant, and I'm just finishing on that, like saying you can work in New York and you can still work in a restaurant that cares about environment, about sustainability, about community, about good food, about caring for each other, and still being a profitable business. It's doable if you put out the work and you give it back.
Yeah. It's going to be a really exciting open. I kind of, sitting here talking to you guys, I can't wait to get in. So you're gonna let me know when that happens.
Yeah,
November, December, whenever.
Somewhere.
Yeah,
somewhere.
You do a little. I mean, I don't have
soon
to be friends and family, but soon. No, it's great because again, I think you're doing something that's really a unique statement in the space of restaurants. I mean, it's to consider health as front and center with every bloody recipe. Through desserts, which is another challenge. We didn't even talk about that yet. Like, because, you know, when you start removing butter and sugar and all the various fats we play with in desserts and trying to, I mean, it's, how do you make that approachable and delicious? And you've done it. You did it at the last place. I'm sure you're going to succeed.
Let's hope so.
Succeed again. and the wine thing. I think it's really interesting. There was a Portuguese tasting. Is Evan Goldstein, is he a master? Evan, you know him? San Francisco guy?
He's an awesome guy.
Funny guy. But kudos to him. And by the way, what you just said, Pasqualino, is why we love you. Because you're one of these people that had so much knowledge in your head. But your ability to communicate it and your sort of down-to-earth, like, demystification of things is really why everybody loves to sit down and drink wine with you and talk wine with you. Because it isn't geeky, and it isn't just a bunch of technical people making these ridiculous comments about whatever it is that we don't know what the fuck they're talking about, you know? It's like, okay, and then, like, I can ask you a really stupid question, and you're like, it's not a stupid question, I'll answer it. Like, here's what I think, you know, how these phenols affect this and where they might be coming from. But anyway, Evan led this Portuguese tasting, and it was great. He was just really, really funny, really knows the region, was really passionate. And I was surprised. We tasted 12 or maybe 10 or 12 wines. There were 6 or 7 producers there. And I think half of them in Portugal, half of those whose wines we tasted were doing bio now.
I know, it's... It's coming. It's taking the world. Like it's for the best. Huh? It's the future anyway. You have to take care of the farming. You're like, not only for the plants, but for yourself and for your kids. There is no other way. You can't continue to do the monoculture and the very heavily more industrialized technological approach. Like, it needs to come back to kind of a balance between more observation and not only hyper rationalistic number.
And kudos to places. I want to give a shout out to our boys down at Contra Wild Air because they got a really good review last week.
Yeah.
Really good. Glad to see those. I had to email them, call them up, test them that day. Two stars, yeah. Great. And
great.
That whole wine
Blood
list is great. All. Actually, the day last time you were here, Zev was sitting in that corner table,
yeah.
And we walked in. I'm like, how funny is this? Vaseline's my guest. Zev's over there, like with 18 bottles of wine, and he does a lot of the wines that they're mm-hmm. buying is. Straight to his program.
No, they are showing that it's possible to make it at that level and super committed. No, the guys are doing a fantastic job.
How many seats in the restaurant?
It's going to be around like the two spaces. We are going to have two different spaces plus a small private dining, but it's like 150
each. Including private dining.
Yeah.
So it's not small. It's big.
It's not small.
Kitchen's decent? Because your kitchen, the other space, was retardedly big.
Yeah, it's actually kind of one of the great things about, you know, downsizing, at least, you know, in comparison to the old space, is that we shrink our footprint in the kitchen so everyone all of a sudden is closer together. And there's now this kind of separation between front of house and back of house that's going to be taken away. Because you saw the old space, you know, like me and Pascaline communicating to each other about how we're going to do a pairing or whatever it is kind of us running past each other at, you know, 100 miles an hour as she's trying to scale, you know, five flights of stairs to get back to the restaurant. So having us all together in a cozy space, I think it's going to be good for everyone. From a learning point of view in the kitchen, you know, having everyone kind of at a arm's reach is a great thing from a chef's perspective because you kind of get to have eyes on everything opposed to kind of having to, you know, look around walls and chase people down corridors.
Yeah, that's, I mean, most New York kitchens, when they're built in the modern era, you know, the smallest space is the kitchen because it's, you make money off of asses and seats. You don't make money off of stainless steel tables for more people to peel carrots on, except with hotels. That's where you'd see these grandiose kitchens. And I remember the first time I went to the Rouge Kitchen, I'm like, what was this place? And it was the old Copacabana, which is where they had that long shot that Scorsese filmed when what's-his-name walks in the employee's entrance and goes through the kitchen. That was such a great shot. But that's the space. And it's almost too big because people get lost. You've got these rooms and acres and corners. And, like, tight's good because your eyeballs are on everybody. And you have to be more efficient. You're working with a little less space, cleaner, neater, tighter, more focused.
Yeah, and it just brings everyone, you know, brings everyone together. So part of it, you know, kind of like what Pascaline touched on is this, you know, the idea that we're all learning from each other and creating an environment where, you know, restaurants are hard to work in. So how do we reinvest in, you know, our employees? Like, what makes them want to come to work every day? It's not for the glorious paycheck, you know, and
we'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah. This whole Danny Meyer, this was a hell of a week. I mean, it blew up. I don't know.
Crazy.
Right. This is a crazy story. And, you know, my hat's off to Danny for trying this experiment of his. But one question before we get to that, because I'd love you guys to weigh in. So you've been closed for a year? The old Rouge closed like last fall, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right? So you've got one of the crises in New York, and this will kind of be a good segue into what Danny's doing. I'm in kitchens all the time. I'm an ex-restaurant guy, an ex-chef, and so all I do is talk to chefs. It's kind of my only reason to be here, I think, is to somehow be that lens that the public can see the other that world through. But I'm, you know, everyone says, dude, you know, if we could get line cook, we can't keep line cook. I'm losing line cooks. Every chef everywhere, 2 stars, 3 stars, doesn't matter. New York City is like, there is a shortage of dedicated line cooks. Part of it is this town's fucking expensive, and restaurants don't pay that much for line cooks. It's really hard to keep them. And kids are leaving. I mean, kids are leaving restaurants to work at a restaurant that's 3 subway stops closer to home, or leaving the city entirely because they could go to somewhere else where that wage for a line cook will actually afford you an apartment that isn't, you know, with a subway and a bus and an hour and a half commute from the kitchen you work in. How are you doing? You've retained some of your crew from the old Rouge?
Yeah, we're super excited because we've got a core crew. You know, a couple of guys are coming back on board. And the philosophy just trickles over from, you know, old Rouge somewhere where we had a very strong... We were always most successful with our promotions that were from within side because we have this, you know, kitchen culture where it's not always the same as every other kitchen. So, you know, people coming in, especially at a higher level, would struggle with that. And we got to the stage where our cooks were at such a high level that if ever we brought anyone, you know, when we try to bring people in over the top of them, it kind of made it hard because we already had all these cooks at this level that were would turn around and say, well, hey, look, I can already do this job. So we found, you know, for the most part, our success came from promoting within, and we started to realize that, you know, like everybody in kind of human nature, people want to see a career path. So they want to work in restaurants where they can say, okay, I can see how I'm going to progress over the next couple of years if I do the work and if I can meet the standard. So them seeing that there's, you know, potential for just moving through the sections, learning each section, being promoted to a, you know, a tournon and becoming a senior cook, and then realizing that beyond that, there's a chance to become a sous chef and, you know, management within the kitchen. We got this huge reinvestment in people. And, you know, our old space, we were open for 6 years. When we closed, we had lots of people that were kind of hitting the three-year mark, which is kind of a, you know, it's rarely heard of at a cook level.
That's correct. Because, you know, at some point, I was a cook too. I've learned enough from this place. Yeah. I'm out of here. Now I'm going to go work for that guy and learn something else because I've got this healthy thing down, or I've got your style down. Bye, chef.
So we're just trying to, you know, we're very, across our, you know, our whole team, it's about pushing each other. So we're always learning from each other. And we kind of push that down to the cooks as well, you know. So the cooks are part of the process. You know, there's no, you're not just coming in, you're going to do your section, you're going to do the recipes I tell you to do, and then you're going to go home. It's like, okay, how can we make this better? And, you know, a lot of times what's interesting is that it's the cooks that are physically cooking this food in the heat of service. Right. And they're doing this repetition.
Again and again, yep.
So it's them, you know, you might say, okay, this is how I think it's the most efficient way to do it, but they're the ones standing there doing it. So, you know, they get to invest in the menu because they're saying, oh, okay, why don't we tweak this? I think this is going to work. And we can kind of work through that. And, you know, I think for them to be able to see their input affect how the restaurant actually performs is what kind of gives you that buy-in.
Well, good. Good. I mean, you've got a core coming back that's, because they'll help. I mean, that's going to give the consistency that you need to sort of rebrand yourself downtown with people that have already been through the paces, know the technique, know the recipes, know you, know what you're, how, what you're aiming for, and they've already hit that mark.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of key. It's the knowing, you know, having a couple of people that know what I expect from them and understand what, you know, how we work and what our kitchen culture and restaurant culture is, and then, you know, them helping to kind of distill that in the new blood, which is also going to help push us because we're going to have some fresh eyes and some fresh ideas coming in. So I think it's exciting. You know, we're just ready to get going.
So either of you, just this Danny thing, which is kind of really revolutionary. So Danny is one of the most successful impresarios of this generation. I think Danny and Drew Nieperon are two of the guys that kind of stand head and shoulders above the rest of the crowd. Danny with what he did in Union Square area neighborhood and his Union Square hospitality group, and Drew with Myriad downtown in Tribeca. You know, Danny decides after all these years and staff meetings that no more tipping is going to start at the Modern, and pretty soon it'll be as all as restaurants, and it's going to be, I can only imagine the menu prices have to go up by 15-18%. It'll be like France, it'll be like other places where we go where there is no tipping and that's the norm, and the idea is to sort of share a little bit that money, spread it a little bit differently to pay the line cooks more. What's the beginning of something new, a one-off experiment? What do you guys think? Too soon to say?
Yeah, I think it's hard. I think it's too soon to say here, but I think, you know, if you look how it works in, you know, France, England, we have the same kind of system. I always have this conversation with people when they say, oh, you know, we have to tip, otherwise you get bad service. I was like, well, if you go to London, you can eat in a lot of great restaurants and you don't get bad service. Like, so that's, it's kind of, you know, it's a cultural shift, which I think is going to be the hardest thing. But I think the fact that, you know, Danny Meyer has done it and is going to make that brave step, it will help other people kind of follow.
Yeah.
You know, my feeling is that whether it's quick or slow, at some point it's going to eventually end up being that way.
Interesting. My old friend Drew weighed in on it like the other way. Drew's like, dude, this is America. We tip. This is how it's always been. Sorry. Like, done. Yeah. Any more questions for this interview? This is front of the house, back. This is how it's always been done. It's like, it's been that, that is our history. So I don't know. I just give credit to Danny for trying this. He's a real innovative guy. Pasolini, I had a wine. Hold on, I had a wine. So my son got the quiet question about cheese in white wine answered, which is so good. Thank you so much. He's been bugging me with that for years. And you explained so beautifully to him. So I had this wine the other day. Where did I write it down? Where was it? Oh, come on. Where are my notes? I wrote that on a piece of paper. Here it is. I never heard this before. And you're going to explain this to me a little bit. So it was called, it was just Teso Blanco. So it was 59% Palomino, which is a grape you see in sherry, a grape I never heard of called Ruffet Blanco.
Yeah, Ruffetti. Yeah.
You've heard of that. See you. Fuck you. And another one, and Muscatel, 12%. But listen, it was bio-organic farmed from Mogaraz, Mogaraz, I think I'm pronouncing that right, Spain. And then it was aged under flour, which is that little, like, lip, yeah. that little thing that you see for, like, 5 months in Big French. It was the most ridiculously delicious white wine, which is so cool. Like, $23 bottle of wine, slightly oxidative, like, nutty, almost, like, toasted grains on the nose. And then I had gone in there. This is at September Wines. And I asked them if they had a Sauvignon. I was kind of in the mood for something, like, taut and acid-driven and oxidative. Your favorite, Chanel, from Loire. And the kid ran upstairs from the basement and said, try this. And he was right on. It was a little more lush, a little rounder in mid-palate. Bloody delicious.
You liked it?
Yeah. Loved it. Oh, so what was this, that idea of, like, that? Why? Why'd they do that? Why is he playing around like that? What do you think as a wine? Well,
it's a very natural phenomenon. You find
it just occurs.
No, yeah. In certain regions, like the most famous one is the Jura region where you get that flour. You know, it's just there is, you were talking about terroir, there is just environment where you get yeast that are going to develop in a very specific way. And some of them are just going to basically go on your top of your wine and they're going to protect the wine from oxidation. So we call that biological oxidation. So you get that flour layers because you have a certain pH, alcohol level in that usually barrel. And it's just going to kind of infuse in wines these very specific flavors, like you are talking about, this curry, salty, nutty, sesame-like. So it's a huge tradition in southern Spain. It's a huge tradition in the Jura. You can find it from times to times in other regions, but it's coming back in favor a lot because of Jura is very big today.
Right.
And it's you know, it's part of this extraordinary anomaly of those anomaly because it's not the norm everywhere of the biological world. And it's good that it's back because for a long time people were just too clean. You know, they were scared of that. They were scared of that taste. Like winemakers are very scared of this type of flavor profile. And it's super interesting and very good.
Super delicious, super alive. I mean, the bottle didn't last long, and I was alone.
No, they're very
delicious.
Very
I just
food friendly.
Back to my glass.
Yes, savory.
So thanks, Pascaline. Next time you're coming back, we're just going to talk about wine. Just talk about wine. Yeah. You are so good.
Let's talk
and
about wine.
Chef, it was great to have you in. Because
you need to eat his food now. Like, my wine are great, but his food is delicious.
So maybe once you reopen, we'll get you back in. And I'm going to get you back in once before that if I can. I'll beg favors. Pascaline Lepeltier, Googler. She's amazing. And you just heard that answer. Was that like the best like one-sentence answer on what I loved about that wine? Thank you, Pascaline, for that. Andy Bennett, good luck with the reopen. I know you're going to kill it. Rouge Tomat, the address, please.
126 West 18th Street.
So you're between 6th and 5th? 6th and 7th? 6th and 7th.
By the Metropolitan Pavilion.
Oh, why would they have all the tastings and all that stuff? South side of the block?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, right by, Metropolitan. Everyone knows that. That's where you're constantly. You go up to the 5th floor, the 4th floor, and you take a little thing.
We'll be on the 2 little floor. There's this old stagecoach from, like, 1863.
Yeah, I saw a picture of the building. You were, I think, outside of it in the New York Times piece. Florence, thanks so much for coming
on.
When Rouge Tomat opens, I will be there, hopefully somewhere in that early rush of diners.
I hope.
We'll find back. And Pascaline, you are such a treasure to have on the show. Always thank you for being a friend and for being so generous with what you know about wine.
You're way too kind.
Nope, you're the best. Folks, who's on next week? Let me tell you really quickly who's on next week because I'm supposed to promo. I used to do this. Next week, I've got Michael Anthony. There we go. Michael Anthony, Vegans for Veg. And I've got the kid who just got one Michelin star, the new chef at Rebel, however you pronounce it. And maybe I can get Patrick Capiello to come out. Maybe I will.
Oh, you should.
I should, because he's there too. He's so much fun. That's next week's show. See you then. Bye.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.